though the elements were the same. I finished quickly, in 3 minutes. I wanted to use the class to test what kind of painting I could do of her. What I discovered in doing this was that, as a model for a painting, she had a lot of unique possibilities hidden away inside. I'd never really consciously observed her before, but now, looking at her carefully as the subject of a drawing, I found her face far more intriguing than my original vague impression. It wasn't just that she had lovely features. She was, indeed, a beautiful girl, but a closer observation showed a kind of imbalance at work. And behind that unstable expression, there was a latent energy, like some agile animal lurking in the tall grass. I wanted to see if I could capture that impression, but it was next to impossible to do that in 3 minutes, in chalk on a blackboard. Basically impossible, I should say. I needed more time to observe her face and dissect all the elements, and I had to know more about this young girl. I left the chalk sketch of her on the blackboard, and after the children had all left, I stayed behind, arms folded, studying the sketch. I tried to determine if there was anything of Menshiki in her features, but I couldn't decide. I could detect a resemblance in certain features, in others not so much. It could go either way. But if I had to give one feature, it would be the eyes, a shared look in their eyes, the distinctive way their eyes would flash for an instant. If you stare long enough deep into the bottom of a clear spring, you discover a kind of lump that emits light. You can't see it unless you look very closely. That lump soon wavers and loses shape. The more carefully you look, the more you start to wonder if it might all be an illusion. But something there is unmistakably glowing. Having done countless portraits of people, occasionally I'll sense someone giving off that glow. Not many people have it. But this girl and Menshiki were among these rare few. The middle-aged receptionist at the school came into the classroom to straighten up and stood beside me, admiring the drawing. "That's Maria Akikawa, isn't it?" she said at first glance. "A very nice likeness. It looks like she's about to start moving. It's a waste to have to erase it." "Thank you," I said. I got up from my desk, picked an eraser, and completely wiped the sketch away. The commendatore finally made an appearance the next day, Saturday. It was the first time since Tuesday night at the dinner at Menshiki's that he, to borrow his phrase, materialized. I was back from food shopping, in the living room reading a book, when I heard the sound of the bell tinkling from the studio. I went into the studio and found the commendatore seated on the shelf, lightly shaking the bell next to his ear, as if making sure of the subtle sound. When he spotted me, he stopped ringing the bell. "It's been a while," I said.
"Negative. It has been nothing of the kind," the commendatore said curtly. "An idea travels around the world in units of hundreds, thousands of years. A day or two does not count as time."
"How did you like Mr. Menshiki's dinner party?"
"Ah, yes, an interesting dinner that was. I could not partake of the food, of course, but did feast my eyes on it. And Menshiki is a fascinating fellow, always thinking several steps ahead, and there is much pent up inside him."
He asked me to do a favor for him.
"Affirmative."
The commendatore gazed at the ancient bell in his hand. He did not seem interested. "I heard it all quite clearly, but it is not something that has much to do with me. It is a practical matter, a worldly matter, you could say, that is between my friends and Menshiki." "Is it all right if I ask a question?" I said. The commendatore rubbed his goatee with his palm.
"Affirmative, but I do not know if I will be able to answer."
"It's about Tomohiko Amada's painting, Killing Commendatore. I assume you know the painting, since you borrowed one of the figures. The painting seems based on an incident in Vienna in 1938.
something Tomohiko Amada himself was involved in. Do you know anything about that?
Arms folded, the commendatore thought this over. Finally, he narrowed his eyes and spoke.
There are plenty of things in history that are best left in the shadows. Accurate knowledge does not improve people's lives. The objective does not necessarily surpass the subjective, you know. Reality does not necessarily extinguish fantasy.
Generally speaking, I said, that might be so, but that painting is calling out to anyone who sees it. I get the sense that Tomohiko Amada painted it to privately capture an event that was essential to him, but that he could not share with others. He changed the characters and setting to another age and made a metaphorical confession, using his newly acquired skills in Japanese-style painting. I even get the feeling that that was the sole reason he abandoned Western painting and converted to Japanese art.
Cannot you just let the painting speak for itself? The commendatore said softly. If that painting wants to say something, then best to let it speak. Let metaphors be metaphors, a code, a sieve. Is there something wrong with that?
A sieve? But I let it go.
No, nothing's wrong with that, I said. I'd just like to know what made Tomohiko Amada paint it. It's clear that the painting is expecting something. The picture was, without a doubt, painted for a specific purpose.
The commendatore continued to rub his beard with his palm as if recalling something.
Franz Kafka was quite fond of slopes, he said. He was drawn to all sorts of slopes. He loved to gaze at homes built on the middle of a slope. He would sit by the side of the street for hours, staring at houses built like that. He never grew tired of it and would sit there, tilting his head to one side, then straightening it up again. A kind of strange fellow. Did you know this?
Franz Kafka and slopes?
No, I didn't, I said. I'd never heard of that. But does knowing that make one appreciate his works more?
I didn't respond to his question.
So you knew Franz Kafka too? Personally? He does not know about me personally, of course, the commendatore said.
He chuckled as if recalling something.
This might have been the first time I'd seen him laugh out loud. Was there something about Franz Kafka to make him chuckle? His expression returned to normal, and he went on. The truth is a symbol, and symbols are the truth. It is best to grasp symbols the way they are. There's no logic or facts, no pig's belly button or ant's balls. When people try to use a method other than the truth to follow along the path of understanding, it is like trying to use a sieve to hold water. I am telling you this for your own good. Better to give it up. Sadly, what Menshiki is doing is similar to that.
So no matter what, it's a wasted effort?
No one can ever float something full of holes on water.
So what exactly is Mr. Menshiki trying to do?
The commendatore lightly shrugged. Charming lines formed between his eyebrows that reminded me of a young Marlon Brando. I seriously doubted the commendatore had ever seen Elia Kazan's On the Waterfront, but those lines were exactly like Marlon Brando's. Though I had no way of knowing how far he went when it came to referencing his appearance and features. He said, There is very little I can explain to my friends about Tomohiko Amada's killing commendatore. That is because it is, in essence, allegory and metaphor. Allegories and metaphors are not something you should explain in words. You just grasp them and accept them.
The commendatore scratched behind his ear with his little finger, just like a cat will scratch behind its ear before it rains.
I will, however, tell my friends one thing. Nothing that is enormously significant, but tomorrow night you'll get a phone call. A call from Menshiki. Think things over very carefully before you answer. Your answer will be the same no matter how much you think it over, but it is still best to think it over very carefully.
And it's very important to let the other person know you're thinking things over carefully, isn't it? As a gesture.
Affirmative. A hard and fast rule in business is to never accept the first offer. Remember that, and you will never go wrong.
The commendatore chuckled again. He seemed in an especially good mood today.
Changing topics, but I wondered, is it interesting to touch a clitoris?
I don't think you touch it because it's interesting, I said honestly.
From the sidelines, it is hard to understand.
I don't think I get it either, I said. So an idea, too, doesn't necessarily understand everything.
About time for me to disappear, the commendatore said. I have someplace else I need to go. Do not have much time.
And with that, the commendatore vanished.
A gradual, phased disappearance like the Cheshire Cat's.
I went to the kitchen, made a simple dinner, and ate. I considered for a moment what someplace else an idea would need to go to, and naturally had no clue. Like the commendatore had prophesied, at just past 8 the following evening, I got a phone call from Menshiki. I thanked him again for the dinner party. The food was amazing, I said. It was nothing, he replied. I want to thank you, Menshiki said, for letting me have such an enjoyable time. I also thanked him for the payment for the portrait, which was way more than we'd agreed to. Please don't worry about it, Menshiki said modestly. That's only to be expected for such a wonderful painting. Once we'd finished all these polite exchanges, there was a moment of silence. By the way, about Maria Akikawa, Menshiki began, as casually as if discussing the weather. You remember the other day when I asked if you would have her model for a painting?
Of course I remember.
Yesterday I asked Maria, actually Mr. Matsushima, the owner of the Arts and Culture Center, asked her aunt, if it might be possible, and she agreed to model.
I see, I said.
So all the pieces are in place, if you'll agree to paint the portrait.
But Mr. Menshiki, isn't Mr. Matsushima a bit suspicious that you're involved in this?
I've been very careful, so no need to worry. He sees me as acting as your patron of sorts. I hope you're not offended.
I don't mind, I said, but I'm surprised Maria Akikawa agreed. She's so quiet and docile, and strikes me as a timid girl.
Honestly, her aunt didn't like the idea at first. She felt nothing good could come from modeling for a painting. I'm sorry if this offends you as an artist.
No, most people would feel that way.
But Maria herself seemed quite interested in modeling for the painting. She said if you'd paint her, she'd be happy to pose. She's the one who persuaded her aunt to agree.
Why, I wondered. Was there some connection with the sketch of her I did on the blackboard? I didn't venture to bring this up with Menshiki.
Things have worked out perfectly, haven't they? Menshiki said.
I thought it over. Was this really the perfect way for things to go? Menshiki seemed to be waiting for my opinion.
Could you tell me more about how this would unfold?
Menshiki said, It's very simple. You are looking for a model for a painting, and you think that Maria Akikawa, from your art class, would be perfect. So you had the owner of the Arts and Culture Center, Mr. Matsushima, sound out the girl's guardian, her aunt. That's the story. Mr. Matsushima personally recommended you, said you have a sterling character, are an enthusiastic teacher, that you're a talented artist with a promising future. I don't appear anywhere in this. I made sure my name didn't come up. Naturally, she'll be clothed when she models, and her aunt will accompany her, and you'll finish the sessions by noon. Those are the conditions they laid down. What do you think?
Following the commendatore's advice, always turn down first offers, I put on the brakes.
I don't have any problem with the conditions, but can I have a bit more time to think about this?
Of course, Manshiki said calmly. Think about it as much as you'd like. I'm not trying to rush you. Obviously, you're the one who would paint the picture, and if you don't feel like doing it, that's the end of it. I just wanted to let you know that everything's all set as far as I'm concerned. One more thing, perhaps a little off topic, but I'm planning to pay you fully for the painting.
Things are really moving along here, I thought. Everything's evolving amazingly quickly and smoothly, like a ball rolling down a slope. I pictured Franz Kafka seated halfway down the slope, watching the ball roll by. I needed to be cautious.
Can you give me 2 days? I asked. I should be able to give you an answer then.
That's fine. I'll call you again in 2 days, Manshiki said. We ended the call. Truth be told, I really didn't need 2 days to give a reply. I'd already made up my mind. I was dying to paint Maria Akikawa's portrait. Even if someone tried to stop me, I'd take on the task. The only reason for asking for 2 extra days was that I didn't want anyone else to dictate the pace of events. I needed to stop and take a deep breath, something instinct and the Commendatore had taught me.
It is like trying to use a sieve to hold water, the Commendatore said. No one ever can float something full of holes on water.
His words hinted at something, something to come. Chapter 29. Any Unnatural Elements. I spent those 2 days gazing back and forth at the 2 paintings in my studio, Tomohiko Amada's Killing Commendatore and my own painting of the man with the white Subaru Forester. Killing Commendatore was hanging now on the white wall of the studio. The man with the white Subaru Forester was in a corner of the studio facing the wall. Only when I wanted to look at it did I return it to the easel. Other than gaze at those paintings, I killed time reading books, listening to music, cooking, cleaning, weeding the garden, taking walks nearby. I didn't feel like taking up my paintbrush. The Commendatore didn't appear and maintained his silence. As I hiked the mountain roads nearby, I tried to find a place from which I could view Maria Akikawa's house, but I could never find it. When I saw it from Manshiki's house, I gathered it wasn't far from me, but the topography obstructed my view. As I hiked through the woods, I unconsciously was on the lookout for hornets. What I rediscovered, spending 2 days gazing at the paintings, was that my feelings were spot on. Killing Commendatore wanted me to break its code, and the man with the white Subaru Forester wanted the artist, namely me, to not make any more revisions. And both of these appeals were very strong, at least I felt them strongly, and I had to obey. I left the man with the white Subaru Forester as it was, though I did try to fathom the basis for why it wanted to be left as is, and struggled to decipher Killing Commendatore. But both paintings were enveloped in an enigma, as hard as a walnut shell, and I couldn't find the means to crack the shell open. Without the upcoming portrait of Maria Akikawa to deal with, I might very well have spent my days ad infinitum gazing back and forth between these paintings. But in the evening of the 2nd day, Manshiki called, and for the time being, at least, the spell was broken.
"Did you make a decision?" Manshiki said after we'd greeted each other. He was, of course, asking about painting Maria Akikawa's portrait.
"I'll accept the offer," I replied. "But I do have one condition."
"Which is?"
"I can't predict what kind of painting it will turn out to be. I can't know what style I'll paint it in until Maria is actually here and I actually begin. If no good ideas come to me, I might not finish. Or it might be finished, but I might not like it. Or you might not like it. So I'd like to do it spontaneously, not because you commissioned it or because you suggested I do it. a momentary pause. Then Menshiki said probingly, "In other words, if you're not satisfied with the finished painting, it won't end up mine under any circumstances. Is that what you're saying?" "That's a possibility. Anyway, I'd like to be the one who decides what to do with the painting. That's my condition." Menshiki gave it some thought before he spoke. "The only thing I can do, I think, is agree. If not accepting that condition means you won't paint it. I'm sorry about that." "So you want to be more free artistically, not bound by the painting being on commission by me or having any suggestions from me. Is that it? Or is the financial aspect the issue?" "A little bit of both. But what's really important is that I want to do it all more naturally."
"Naturally?"
"I want to get rid of any unnatural elements as much as I can."
"Meaning," Menshiki said, his voice had grown a little hard, "that there's something unnatural in my asking you to paint Maria's portrait?"
"It is like trying to use a sieve to hold water," the commendatore said. "No one can ever float something full of holes on water." I said, "What I mean is, with this painting, I'd like to be on an equal footing with you, not in a relationship that's mixed up with questions of individual interests. I'm sorry if this sounds rude."
"No, it's not rude at all. It's only natural for people to be on an equal footing. Feel free to say anything you'd like to me."
"In other words, I'd like to paint the portrait of Maria Akikawa as a spontaneous act, not one that you had a hand in. Unless I do that, I might not come up with any good ideas about how to paint her. That sort of thing might be a shackle, visible or otherwise."
Menshiki thought about this. "I understand completely," he finally said. "Let's forget about it being a commission. And please forget that I mentioned payment. That was me being overeager, I'm afraid. We can revisit the question of what to do with the painting once it's finished, and you show it to me. Of course, I'll honor your desires as the artist above all. But how about the other request I had? Do you remember? About you casually stopping by my studio while Maria is modeling for me?"
"Correct." I thought it over. "I have no problem with that. I'm acquainted with you, you live in the neighborhood, and just happened to drop by while out for a Sunday stroll. And we just chat for a while. That strikes me as completely natural."
Menshiki seemed relieved. "I'd be very grateful if you'd arrange it. I'll make sure not to get in the way. So can I plan things so that Maria comes over to your place this Sunday morning, and you'll paint her portrait? Actually, Mr. Matsushima will act as intermediary and arrange things between you and the Akikawas."
"That would be fine. Go ahead and set it up. We'll plan on the two of them coming over on Sunday morning at 10, and Maria will sit for the portrait. I'll be sure to finish up by 12. It'll take several weeks to finish, maybe 5 or 6. That's about the size of it."
"I'll be in touch once everything's set."
We'd finished discussing all we needed to.
"Ah, yes," he said, as if suddenly remembering. "I found out a few more things about Tomohiko Amada's time in Vienna. I told you that the failed assassination attempt he was involved in took place right about the time of the Anschluss, but actually it was in the early fall of 1938, about half a year after the Anschluss, in other words. You know the facts about the Anschluss, right?"
"Not in much detail."
"On March 12, 1938, the Wehrmacht smashed across the border with Austria, invaded the country, and soon gained control of Vienna. They threatened President Miklas and made him designate Seyss Inquart, head of the Austrian Nazi Party, as prime minister. Hitler came to Vienna 2 days later. On April 10th, there was a national referendum, a vote on whether Austria should be annexed by Germany. On the surface, it was a free, secret ballot, but the Nazis rigged things so any voter would have to be pretty courageous to vote 9.
The vote was 99.75% ja for the annexation. That's how Austria as a nation vanished, reduced to being a part of Germany. Have you ever been to Vienna?
I'd never been out of the country, let alone to Vienna. I'd never even had a passport.
Vienna's like no other city in the world, Menshiki said. You sense it even after being there for a short time. Vienna's different from Germany. The air's different. The people are different. Same with the food and the music. It's a special place for people to enjoy themselves, to love the arts. But back then Vienna was in total chaos, a brutal storm blowing violently through it. And it was exactly this period of upheaval in Vienna that Tomohiko Amada lived through. The Nazis behaved themselves until the national referendum, but after that they revealed their true, brutal nature. The first thing Hitler did after the Anschluss was build the Mauthausen concentration camp in northern Austria. It took only a few weeks to complete it. Building it was the Nazis' top priority. In a short space of time, tens of thousands of political prisoners were arrested and shipped off to the camp. Most of those sent to Mauthausen were so-called incorrigible political prisoners or antisocial elements, so their treatment was especially cruel. Lots of people were executed there, or died doing harsh physical labor in the quarries. The label incorrigible meant that once you were thrown into that camp, you'd never come out alive. Many anti-Nazi activists weren't sent to the camp, but were tortured and murdered during interrogation, their fate covered up. The aborted assassination attempt that Tomohiko Amada was involved in took place during this chaotic period following the Anschluss. I listened to Menshiki's story without comment. But as I mentioned before, there's no public record at all of any abortive assassination attempt on any Nazi VIP from the summer to fall of 1938, which is pretty strange if you think about it. If such a plot had really existed, Hitler and Goebbels would have spread the news far and wide and used it for political purposes, like they did with Kristallnacht. You know about Kristallnacht, right? The basic facts, yes, I said. I'd seen a movie once that dealt with it. A German embassy official in Paris was shot and killed by an anti-Nazi Jew, and the Nazis used that as an excuse for fomenting anti-Jewish riots throughout Germany. Lots of businesses run by Jews were destroyed, and quite a few people were murdered. The name comes from the way that the glass from the shattered shop windows glittered like crystals. Exactly. That was in November 1938. The German government announced it as a spontaneous rioting, when in reality the Nazi government, with Goebbels leading the way, used the assassination to systematically plan this brutality. The assassin, Herschel Grinspan, carried out the act to protest the cruel treatment of his family as Jews back in Germany. At first, he planned to assassinate the German ambassador, but when he couldn't, he instead shot one of the embassy staff who just happened to be there. Ironically, von Rath, the staff member he shot, was under surveillance by authorities for anti-Nazi sympathies. At any rate, if there had been a plot at the time to assassinate a Nazi official in Vienna, a similar campaign would definitely have taken place. They would have used it as an excuse to increase the suppression of anti-Nazi forces. At least, they wouldn't have quietly covered up the incident. Was there some reason they didn't want it made public? It seems a fact that the incident did take place. Most of the people involved were Viennese college students, and they were all arrested and either executed or murdered, to seal their lips about the plot. One theory is that one of the resistance members was the daughter of a high-ranking Nazi official, and that's why they kept it under wraps. But the facts aren't clear. After the war, there was some testimony given about it, but this was all circumstantial evidence, and it's unsure whether any of it is reliable. By the way, the resistance group's name was Candela. In Latin, it means a candle shining in the darkness underground. The Japanese word for lantern, cantera, derives from this. If all those involved in the plot were killed, that means the only survivor is Tomohiko Amada?
It does seem that way.
Just before the end of the war, the Reich Main Security Office ordered that all secret documents relating to the incident be burned, and the plot was lost to the darkness of history. It would be nice if we could question Tomohiko Amada about the details of what took place, but that would be pretty difficult now.
It would, I said. Up till now, Tomohiko Amada had never spoken of the incident, and his memory had now sunk deep into the thick mud of oblivion. I thanked Menshiki and hung up. Even while his memory was still solid, Tomohiko Amada had maintained a firm silence about the incident. He must have had some private reasons for why he couldn't talk about it. Or perhaps when he left the country, the authorities had forced him to agree to never speak of it. In place of maintaining a lifelong silence, though, he'd left the painting Killing Commendatore. He'd entrusted that painting with the truth he was forbidden to ever speak about, and his feelings about what had occurred. The next evening, Menshiki called again. Maria Akikawa would be coming to my house the following Sunday at 10 a.m., he reported. As he'd mentioned, her aunt would be accompanying her. Menshiki wouldn't be there that first day.
I'll come by after some time has passed, after she's gotten used to posing for you. I'm sure she'll be nervous at first, and it's better that I don't bother you, he said. His voice was a little unsteady. That tone put me on edge as well.
Yes, that sounds like a good idea, I replied.
Come to think of it, though, I might be the one who's the most nervous, Menshiki said after a little hesitation, sounding as if he were revealing a secret. I think I've said this before, but I've never been near Maria Akikawa. Not even once. I've only seen her from a distance.
But if you wanted to get close to her, you could have created an opportunity to do so.
Yes, of course. If I'd wanted to, I could have made any number of opportunities.
But you didn't. Why not?
Uncharacteristically, Menshiki took time to choose his words. He said, I couldn't predict how I'd feel or what I'd say if I was close to her. That's why I've intentionally stayed away. I've been satisfied with being on the other side of the valley, secretly watching her from a distance with high-powered binoculars. Is that a warped way of thinking?
Not particularly, I said, but I do find it a bit odd. But now you've decided to actually meet her at my house. Why?
Menshiki was silent for a time, and then spoke. That's because you're here, and can act as an intermediary.
Me? I said in surprise. Why me? Not to be rude or anything, but you hardly know me, and I don't know you well either. We only met about a month ago. We live across the valley from each other, but our lifestyles couldn't be more different. So why did you trust me that much? And tell me your secrets? You don't seem the type to give away your inner feelings so easily.
Exactly. Once I have a secret, I lock it away in a safe and swallow the key. I don't seek advice from others or reveal things to them.
Then how come, I'm not sure how to put this, you've confided in me?
Menshiki was silent for a time. It's hard to explain, but I got the feeling the first day I met you that it's all right to let my guard down. Call it intuition, and that feeling only grew stronger after I saw my portrait. I decided this is a trustworthy person, someone who would accept my way of seeing things, my way of thinking, even if I have a slightly odd and twisted way of seeing and thinking. A slightly odd and twisted way of seeing and thinking, I thought. I'm really happy you'd say that, I said, but I don't think I understand you as a person. You go way beyond the scope of my comprehension. Frankly, many things about you simply surprise me. Sometimes I'm at a loss for words.
But you never try to judge me. Am I right?
That was true, now that he'd said it. I'd never tried to apply some standard to judge Manshiki's words and actions. I didn't praise them and didn't criticize them. They simply left me, as I'd said, at a loss for words.
You might be right, I admitted. And you remember when I went down to the bottom of that hole? When I was down there by myself for an hour?
Of course.
It never even occurred to you to leave me there forever in that dark, dank hole, right?
True, but that sort of idea wouldn't occur to a normal person.
Are you sure about that?
What could I say? I couldn't imagine what lay deep in other people's minds.
I have another request, Manshiki said.
And what is that?
It's about next Sunday, when Maria and her aunt come to your place, Manshiki said. I'd like to watch your house then with my binoculars, if you don't mind.
I don't mind, I said. I mean, the Commendatore had watched my girlfriend and me right beside us when we'd had sex. Having someone watch my terrace from afar wasn't about to faze me now.
I thought it'd be best to tell you in advance, Manshiki said, as if excusing himself.
I was impressed all over again how strangely honest he was. We finished talking and hung up the phone. I'd been holding the phone tightly against me, and the spot above my ear ached. The next morning, I received a certified letter. I signed the receipt the mailman held out for me and got a large envelope. Getting it didn't exactly make me feel cheerful. My experience is that certified mail is never good news. And, as expected, the mail was from a law office in Tokyo, and inside were two sets of divorce papers. There was also a stamped, self-addressed envelope. The only thing accompanying the forms was a letter with business-like instructions from the lawyer. It said that all I needed to do was read over the forms, check them, and, if I didn't have any objections, sign and seal one set and send it back. If there are any points that you're uncertain about, the letter said, feel free to contact the attorney in charge. I glanced through the forms, filled in the date, signed them, and affixed my seal. I didn't particularly have any points that were uncertain. Neither of us had any financial obligations toward the other, no estate worth dividing up, no children to fight a custody battle over. A very simple, easy-to-understand divorce. Divorce 101, you could say. Two lives had overlapped into one, and 6 years later had split apart again. That was it. I slipped the documents inside the return envelope and put the envelope on top of the dining room table. Tomorrow, when I went to town to teach my art class, all I'd need to do was toss it inside the mailbox in front of the station. That whole afternoon, I sort of half-gazed at the envelope on the table and gradually came to feel like the entire weight of 6 years of married life was crammed inside that envelope. All that time, time tinged with all kinds of memories and emotions, was stuffed inside an ordinary business envelope, gradually suffocating to death. I felt a weight pressing down on my chest, and my breathing grew ragged. I picked up the envelope, took it to the studio, and placed it on the shelf next to the dingy, ancient bell. I shut the studio door, returned to the kitchen, poured a glass of the whiskey Masahiko had given me, and drank it. My rule was not to drink while it was still light out, but I figured it was okay sometimes. The kitchen was totally still and silent. No wind outside, no sound of cars, not even any birds chirping. I had no particular problem about getting divorced. For all intents and purposes, we already were divorced. and I had no emotional hang-up about signing and sealing the official documents. If that's what she wanted, fine. It was a legal formality, nothing more. But when it came to why and how things had turned out this way, the sequence of events was beyond me. I understood, of course, that over time and as circumstances changed, a couple could grow closer or move apart. Changes in a person's feelings aren't regulated by custom, logic, or the law. They're fluid, unstable, free to spread their wings and fly away. Like migratory birds have no concept of borders between countries. But these were all just generalizations, and I couldn't easily grasp the individual case here, that this woman, Yuzu, refused to love this man, me, and chose instead to be loved by someone else. It felt terribly absurd, a horribly ugly way to be treated. There wasn't any anger involved, I think. I mean, what was I supposed to be angry with? What I was feeling was a fundamental numbness, the numbness your heart automatically activates to lessen the awful pain when you want somebody desperately and they reject you. A kind of emotional morphine. I couldn't easily forget Yuzu. I still wanted her. But say she were living in a place across the valley from my house, and say I owned a pair of high-powered binoculars, would I really try to peer into her daily life through those lenses? I sincerely doubted it. What I mean is, in the first place, I wouldn't pick that sort of place to live in. It would be like building a torture rack just for me. The whiskey did its job, and I went to bed before 8 and fell asleep. At 1:30 a.m., I woke up and couldn't get back to sleep. It was a long, lonely haul until dawn. I didn't read, didn't listen to music, just sat on the sofa in the living room, blankly staring out into the empty, dark space. All sorts of thoughts swirled through my head, most of which I shouldn't have thought about. I wish the Commendatore were with me, I thought. I wish we could talk about something together. Anything. The topic didn't matter. Just hearing his voice would be enough. But the Commendatore was nowhere to be seen, and I had no way to summon him. Chapter 30. It really depends on the person. The next afternoon, I mailed the divorce papers I'd signed and sealed. I didn't include any letter. I simply tossed the stamped return envelope with the documents into the mailbox in front of the station. Just having that envelope out of the house felt like a burden had been lifted. I had no idea what legal route these documents would take next. Not that it mattered. They could follow whatever path they liked. And Sunday morning, just before 10, Maria Akikawa came to my house. A bright blue Toyota Prius climbed the slope with barely a sound and came to a stop near my front door. In the bright Sunday sunlight, the car sparkled grandly, vibrantly, like it was brand new, just unwrapped. A lot of different cars had found their way to my place recently. Manchiki's silver Jaguar, my girlfriend's red Mini, the chauffeur-driven black Infiniti that Manchiki had sent for me, Masahiko's old black Volvo, and now the blue Toyota Prius that belonged to Maria Akikawa's aunt, and of course my own Toyota Corolla station wagon, covered with dust for so long I couldn't recall what the original color had been. I imagine people have all sorts of reasons for choosing the car they drive, and of course I had no clue why Maria's aunt had chosen a blue Toyota Prius. It looked less like a car than a giant vacuum cleaner. The quiet Prius engine shut off, and the surroundings grew that much quieter. The doors opened, and Maria Akikawa and the woman I took to be her aunt got out. The aunt looked young, though early 40s would have been my guess. She had on dark sunglasses and a gray cardigan over a simple light blue dress. She carried a shiny black handbag and had on low, dark gray shoes, good shoes for driving. She shut her door, removed the sunglasses, and put them in her handbag. Her hair fell to her shoulders and was neatly curled, though not with the excessive perfection of someone just emerged from a hair salon. No accessories, other than a gold brooch on her collar. Maria had on a black cotton sweater and a brown, knee-length wool skirt. I'd only seen her in her school uniform up till then, and she seemed different. Side by side, they looked like a mother and child from a refined, elegant household, though I knew from Menshiki that they weren't actually mother and child. As always, I observed them through a gap in the curtain, and when the bell rang, I went to the entrance and opened the front door. Maria's aunt had a very tranquil, calm way of speaking. She had lovely features, not the kind of beautiful woman that would turn heads, but neat, regular features. A natural, subdued smile graced her lips, like the pale moon at dawn. She was carrying a box of cookies as a present. I was the one who had asked to have Maria model for me, so there was no reason for her to bring me anything, but she was probably the type of person who'd had it drummed into her since she was little that when you visit someone's house, you always should bring along a present. So I simply thanked her and accepted it, and showed the two of them into the living room. Our house isn't so far from here, a stone's throw, really, but when you drive, it's a roundabout road to get here, the aunt said. Her name was Shoko Akikawa, she told me, the sho written with the character that meant a traditional Japanese pan flute. I knew, of course, that this was Tomohiko Amada's house, but this is the first time I've ever been up here, even though we live next door. I've been living here, taking care of the place, since this spring, I explained. Yes, I heard. I'm glad it turned out we're neighbors. I look forward to getting to know you better. Shoko bowed deeply and thanked me for teaching Maria. My niece really enjoys going to the school, thanks to you, she said. I wouldn't say I'm exactly teaching her, I said. Basically, I just enjoy drawing together with all the pupils. But I understand you're a very skilled instructor. I've heard many people say that. That I found hard to believe, but I made no comment, letting these words of praise pass unremarked. Shoko was raised well, a woman who put a premium on social niceties. Seated side by side like this, the first thing anyone would notice about Maria Akikawa and her aunt is that their features didn't resemble each other in the slightest. From a little ways off, they seemed a well-matched mother and child, but up close it was hard to find anything in common in their appearance. Maria had lovely features, too, and Shoko Akikawa was without doubt quite attractive, but their features were poles apart. If Shoko Akikawa's features were aiming at gaining a wonderful balance, Maria Akikawa's aimed at destroying equilibrium, demolishing a set framework. If Shoko Akikawa aimed at a gentle, overarching harmony and stability, Maria Akikawa sought an asymmetrical friction. Still, one could sense from the mood between them that despite all this, they had a warm, healthy relationship. In a sense, they were more relaxed around each other than a real mother and daughter. They seemed to maintain a comfortable distance. At least, that's the impression I got. Of course, I knew nothing about why a woman like Shoko, beautiful and refined, was still single, and put up with living far off in the hills like this in her older brother's home. Perhaps she'd had a lover, a mountain climber who'd perished in an attempt to reach the summit of Mount Everest by the most arduous route, and had pledged to remain single forever, cherishing beautiful memories of her lover in her heart. Or perhaps she was having a long-term affair with a charming married man. In any event, it wasn't my business. Shoko walked over to the windows on the west side and gazed with great interest at the view of the valley from there. It's the same mountain we see from our place, but this is a slightly different angle, and it doesn't look the same at all, she said, sounding impressed. Menshiki's huge white mansion glittered on top of that mountain, and he was probably over there watching my house now through his binoculars. How did that mansion appear from her house, I wanted to ask, but it seemed risky to broach that topic right off the bat. It was hard to tell what that might lead to. Wanting to steer clear of that, I quickly led them into the studio. "This is where I'll have Maria model for me," I said to them.
"This must be where Tomohiko Amada did his painting," Shoko said, gazing with great interest around the studio.
"I believe so," I said.
"There's a different feeling here, even from the rest of your house, don't you think?"
"I'm not sure. Living here day to day, I don't really get that sense."
"What do you think, Mari-chan?" Shoko asked Maria. "Don't you find there's an unusual sort of feeling to the room?"
Maria was busy looking around the studio and didn't reply. She probably hadn't heard her aunt's question. I wanted to hear her reply as well.
"While the two of you are working here, I'll wait in the living room if that's all right," Shoko asked.
"It's all up to Maria. The most important thing is creating an environment where she can feel relaxed. Whether you stay here or not, either way is fine with me."
"I don't want Auntie to be here," Maria said, the first time she'd opened her mouth that day. She spoke quietly, but it was a terse announcement with no room for negotiation. "That's fine. I'll do as you'd prefer. I figured that's how it would be, so I brought a book to read," Shoko replied calmly, not bothered by her niece's stern tone. She was probably used to that sort of exchange. Maria completely ignored what her aunt said and crouched down a bit, gazing steadily at Tomohiko Amada's Killing Commendatore hanging on the wall. The look in her eyes as she studied this rectangular Japanese painting was intense. She examined each and every detail of the painting, as if etching every element of it in her memory. Come to think of it, I thought, this might be the first time anyone else had ever laid eyes on this painting. It had totally slipped my mind to move the painting somewhere out of sight. Too late now, I thought.
"Do you like that painting?" I asked the girl. Maria didn't reply. She was concentrating so much on the painting that she didn't hear my voice. Or did she hear it, but was just ignoring me?
"I'm sorry, she really goes her own way sometimes," Shoko said, interceding. "She focuses so hard sometimes she blocks out everything else. She's always been that way, with books and music, paintings and movies." I don't know why, but neither Shoko nor Maria asked whether the painting was by Tomohiko Amada, so I didn't venture to explain. And of course, I didn't tell them the title, Killing Commendatore, either. I wasn't too worried that they'd both seen the painting. Neither one probably would notice that this was a special work not included in Amada's oeuvre. Things would be different if Menshiki or Masahiko spotted it. I let Maria examine Killing Commendatore to her heart's content. I went to the kitchen, boiled water, and made tea. I put cups and the teapot on a tray and carried it to the living room. I added the cookies Shoko had brought as a gift. Shoko and I sat on chairs in the living room and sipped tea while chatting about life in the mountains, the weather in the valley, etc. This kind of relaxed conversation was necessary before I began to work in earnest. Maria kept studying Killing Commendatore by herself for a while, then finally, like a very curious cat, slowly made her way around the studio, picking things up and checking them out along the way. Brushes, tubes of paint, a canvas, and even the old bell that had been exhumed from underground. She held the bell and shook it a few times. It made its usual light jingling sound. "How come there's an old bell here?" Maria, facing a blank space, didn't seem to be addressing her question to anyone in particular. She was asking me, of course.
"The bell came nearby, from out of the ground," I said. "I just happened to cross it. I think it's connected with Buddhism somehow, like a priest would ring it as he recited sutras." She rang it again next to her ear.
"Kind of a strange sound," she commented.
Once more, I was impressed that such a faint sound could have reached out from underground in the woods and found me in the house. Maybe there was some special way of shaking it.
You shouldn't touch someone else's things without permission, Shoko Akikawa cautioned her niece.
I don't mind, I said. It's not valuable.
Maria seemed to quickly lose interest in the bell. She returned it to the shelf, plunked down on the stool in the middle of the room, and gazed at the scenery out the window.
If you don't mind, I was thinking of starting, I said.
All right, then I'll stay here and read, Shoko said, an elegant smile rising to her lips. From her black bag, she took out a thick paperback with a bookstore's paper cover. I left her there, went into the studio, and shut the door between it and the living room. Maria and I were alone in the room. I had Maria sit in a dining room chair, one with a backrest, and I sat on my usual stool. We were about 6 feet apart.
Could you sit there for a while for me?
You can sit however you'd like. As long as you don't change your position too much, it's okay to move around. No need to sit completely still. Is it okay for me to talk while you're painting? Maria asked probingly.
No problem at all, I said. Let's talk.
That drawing of me you did the other day was great.
The one in chalk on the blackboard?
Too bad it got erased.
I laughed. Can't keep it on the blackboard forever. But if you like that kind of thing, I can do as many as you want. It's simple.
She didn't reply. I picked up a thick pencil and used it as a kind of ruler to measure the various elements of her facial features. Different from a croquis, when drawing a dessin, you need to take time and make sure you have an accurate grasp of the model's features, no matter what kind of painting it ends up being. I think you have a real talent for drawing, Maria said after a period of silence, as if remembering.
Thank you, I said. Hearing that gives me courage.
You need courage?
Sure I do. Everybody needs to have courage. I picked up a large sketchbook and opened it. I'm going to sketch dessin of you today. I enjoy painting with oils directly on a blank canvas, but today I'll stick to drawing detailed dessin. That way I can gradually understand the kind of person you are.
Understand me?
Drawing someone means understanding and interpreting another person. Not with words, but with lines, shapes, and colors.
I wish I could understand myself, Maria said.
I feel the same way, I agreed. I wish I could understand myself, too. But it's not easy. That's why I paint.
Using a pencil, I quickly sketched her face and figure from the waist up. How to transfer her depth to a flat medium was critical, and how to transplant her subtle movements to something static, that too was vital. A dessin sketch determines the outline of those. My breasts are really small, don't you think? Maria asked, out of nowhere.
I wonder, I said.
They're like bread that didn't rise.
I laughed. You've just started junior high. I'm sure they'll get bigger. It's nothing to worry about.
I don't even really need a bra. The other girls in my class all wear bras.
Certainly it was hard to see any development through her sweater. If it really bothers you, you could always pad your bra, I said.
You want me to?
Either way is fine with me. It's not like I'm painting you to capture your breasts. You should do whatever you like.
But don't men like women with big breasts?
Not necessarily, I said. When my younger sister was about your age, her breasts were small too. But that didn't seem to bother her.
Maybe it bothered her, but she just didn't mention it.
Could be, I said. But I don't think that bothered Komi. She had other things to worry about.
Did your sister's breasts get bigger after that?
My hand continued to move the pencil swiftly across the page. I didn't respond to her question. Maria watched my hand glide along the paper.
Did her breasts get bigger after that? Maria asked again.
No, they didn't, I finally gave up and answered. My sister died the year she entered junior high. She was only